Hello, welcome to the Front Pages. I'm Chris Kelly, and today I'm reading from the Thursday, June 30th, 2022 editions of the Hartford Courant and the New York Times. Looking at the photos on the front page of the Times this morning, the first is actually a map of the Midwest that includes Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee, Arkansas, Missouri, and Iowa. Those are all states that surround, if not border on, Illinois. And Illinois is the only state that will be allowing abortions after the decision by the Supreme Court last week. And so people from all of those other states are probably looking at Illinois, I think is what's being suggested here. There's a photograph from the Nile River in Cairo where houseboats and small businesses that were made with floating structures on the river are being destroyed by the government, it says. And there's a photograph of several of those structures there. We'll take a peek at that. But the first story of the morning is accompanied by a photograph of President Biden walking with a couple of other world leaders under the headline, NATO retools its mission for Moscow's aggression. Faced with a newly aggressive Russia, NATO leaders on Wednesday outlined a muscular new vision that names Moscow as a military alliance's primary adversary, but also, for the first time, declares China to be a strategic challenge. It was a fundamental shift for an alliance that was born in the Cold War, but came to view a post-Soviet Russia as a potential ally and did not focus on China at all. But that was before February 24th, when Russian forces poured across the border into Ukraine and Chinese leaders pointedly did not join in a global condemnation that followed. The deepening strategic partnership between the People's Republic of China and the Russian Federation and their mutually reinforcing attempts to undercut rules-based international order run counter to our values and interests, NATO leaders said in a new mission statement issued during their summit in Madrid. The announcement came on a day when a top U.S. intelligence official said victory in Ukraine was not yet in Russia's grasp. The two sides said that they had exchanged more than 200 prisoners of war, and a Ukrainian official said, quote, there are battles everywhere. In a flurry of steps at the summit in Madrid, which ends Thursday, President Biden and other NATO leaders sought to respond to President Putin's resurgent and bellicose Russia. Just before publishing the mission statement, they extended formal membership invitations to the until now non-aligned Nordic countries, Finland and Sweden, paving the way for NATO's most significant enlargement in more than a decade. In a moment when Putin has shattered peace in Europe and attacked the very tenets of the rules-based order, the United States and our allies, we're going to step it up, Mr. Biden said. We're stepping up. The Security General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, announced that thousands of new troops would be deployed in eight countries on NATO's eastern flank. And Mr. Biden said that Washington would deploy an army garrison headquarters and a field support battalion in Poland, the first U.S. forces permanently located on NATO's eastern flank. China's offered a chilling response to the new NATO moves. We oppose certain elements clamoring for NATO's involvement in Asia-Pacific or the Asian-Pacific version of NATO based on military alliance, said China's ambassador to the United Nations, Zhang Jun. The outdated Cold War script must not be reenacted in Asia-Pacific. The turmoil in parts of the world must not be allowed in Asia-Pacific. As for his part, Mr. Putin kept his attention on Central Asia, where he has been visiting to shore up support for Moscow, all the more important now that the West has moved to make Russia a pariah nation. In an apparently calculated bit of Kremlin counter-programming, the Russian president attended a summit of his own, a gathering in Turkmenistan of the five countries bordering the Caspian Sea. He flew to Turkmenistan early on Wednesday from Tajikistan on the second leg of a two-day trip that took him out of Russia for the first time since the Ukraine war began in February. It was also his first overnight foreign trip since the pandemic began. In a brief speech to the other leaders at the summit, including the presidents of Kazakhstan, Iran, and Azerbaijan, Mr. Putin spoke of trade, tourism, fisheries, and environmental issues, though he said not a word about NATO or Ukraine. But later in the day, meeting with reporters after the summit was over, Mr. Putin scoffed at the significance of Finland and Sweden joining NATO, all the while issuing a warning. If military contingents and infrastructure are deployed there, he said, we will have to respond in kind and create the same threats against the territories from which threats are created against us, Mr. Putin said. It's obvious what they don't understand. Ukrainian leaders praised NATO news. We welcome a clear-eyed stance on Russia, as well as a session for Finland and Sweden, Ukraine's foreign minister Dmytro Kuleba said on Twitter. An equally strong and active position on Ukraine will help to protect the Euro-Atlantic security and stability. But it was far from clear that the developments this week could help Ukraine turn the tide in a war in which its forces remain badly outnumbered and outgunned. Mr. Putin has appeared unmoved by foreign condemnations and sanctions as his forces use their superior artillery to bombard Ukrainian cities into submission. On Wednesday, Ukrainian and Western officials said Moscow was dispatching thousands more soldiers and heavy weapons to eastern Ukraine as it struggles to lay claim to the last patch of sovereign Ukrainian territory in the eastern Luhansk province. There are battles everywhere, said Serhiy Hadaj, the head of the Luhansk Regional Military Administration. Everywhere the enemy is trying to break through the line of defense, they are trying to destroy all settlements to later enter only the territory, not the settlement. He said the Russians were using rocket-propelled grenade launchers, artillery, mortars, tanks, bombers, and long-range missiles to clear the land of life so their infantry could advance. Also on the front page, aides testimony reveals friction between parallel January 6 inquiries. The explosive testimony of former Trump White House aide on Tuesday may have increased the likelihood of new prosecutions stemming from the attack on the Capitol, but it also bared lingering conflicts between the Justice Department and congressional investigators. The federal prosecutors working on the case watched the aide's appearance before the House committee investigating January 6, 2021, and were just as astonished by her account of former President Trump's increasingly desperate bid to hold on to power as other viewers. The panel did not provide them with videos or transcripts of her taped interviews with committee members beforehand, according to several officials, leaving them blindsided. The testimony from the aide, Cassidy Hutchinson, who worked for Mr. Trump's final chief of staff, Mark Meadows, came at a critical moment in parallel investigations that will soon converge and possibly collide as the committee wraps up a public inquiry geared for maximum political effect and the department intensifies a high-stakes investigation aimed at securing airtight convictions. Her revelations ramped up calls that the committee summon a former White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, who could verify some of her disclosures. Late Wednesday, the panel said that it had subpoenaed him after he resisted publicly testifying. Committee members have repeatedly suggested that Attorney General Merrick Garland has not moved fast enough to follow up their investigative leads, but for reasons that are not entirely clear, classic Washington bureaucratic territorialism, the department's unwillingness to share information, or the desire to stage manage a successful public forum, members have resisted turning over hundreds of transcripts until they're done with their work. Senior Justice Department officials say that has slowed their investigation. Ms. Hutchinson's name has not yet appeared on subpoenas and other court documents related to their investigation into the effort to overturn the 2020 election, and she did not seem to be a primary witness before the hearings. The committee and its supporters say its independence has allowed it to create an investigative roadmap for the department's subsequent inquiries, even if members remain divided over whether to make an official criminal referral to Mr. Garland. It's fair to regard this series of most recent hearings as a slow-motion referral in plain view of conduct warranting, at minimum, criminal investigation and potential prosecution, said David Loffman, former federal prosecutor and senior Justice Department official. They haven't held anything back. At each of its hearings this month, the panel has presented evidence that members believe could be used to bolster a criminal investigation. The committee has provided new details about cases that could be built around a conspiracy to defraud the American people and Mr. Trump's own donors, as well as plans to submit false slates of electors to the National Archives and obstruct an official proceeding of Congress. At its hearing on Tuesday, the committee laid out how Mr. Trump had forewarning of violence, was derelict as a mob of his loyalists attacked the Capitol, and in fact, agreed with what they were doing. A person familiar with the panel's work said Representative Liz Cheney, a Republican of Wyoming and vice chair of the committee, took a leading role overseeing the team investigating Mr. Trump's inner circle and was instrumental in organizing the surprise hearing featuring Ms. Hutchinson. Over the past month, the committee had aired hours of testimony, none more significant than Ms. Hutchinson's narrative of Mr. Trump's actions on the day of the attack that legal experts believe bolstered a potential criminal case against Mr. Trump for inciting the mob or attempting to obstruct the special session of Congress. Also on the front page, rifts abound over enforcing abortion bans. Deep rifts have emerged among the hundreds of elected district attorneys who will be charged with enforcing the expanding restrictions on abortion, creating a balkanized new legal system within states that are banning the procedure. Dozens of Democratic prosecutors who represent liberal pockets in conservative states already have vowed to resist bans by refusing to bring charges against abortion providers. In many rural areas and outlying suburbs, conservative prosecutors have said that they will enforce their state bans. An opening salvo came this week, just days after the Supreme Court struck down the right to abortion, when a prominent anti-abortion group in Texas urged the police and prosecutors in Dallas and Houston to open criminal investigations into three abortion clinics, and that the group said were preparing to violate the law by scheduling abortions. It is your duty to uphold the law and investigate crimes, the group Texas Right to Life said in its letter, in which it claimed to have phone recordings of clinic employees. We urge you and your officers to investigate this abortion clinic. The demand was quickly made moot when a judge temporarily blocked attempts to resurrect the state's long-dormant, century-old abortion law in the weeks before a new ban takes effect, but it marked the beginning of an explosive new battle over abortion in America. How prosecutors and the police will enforce laws that criminalize abortion in 24 states, some of them carrying penalties of up to 15 years in prison. More than 80 elected prosecutors have already vowed not to. In a joint statement released after the Supreme Court's decision last week, they said that enforcing abortion bans on what had for decades been a legal medical procedure would degrade public trust, especially for sexual assault victims, and drain resources from prosecuting what they call serious crimes. Criminalizing and prosecuting individuals who seek or provide abortion care makes a mockery of justice, the prosecutor said. Prosecutors should not be part of that, but such protection could be limited. In some states with abortion restrictions, Republican attorneys general could intercede to bring abortion cases even if local prosecutors refuse. In Texas, where district attorneys in five of the state's most populous counties have said that they will not, quote, criminalize personal health care decisions, a Republican legislator has proposed a law that could empower conservative rural prosecutors to charge urban residents for violating Texas abortion laws. Other schisms are erupting between neighboring cities and counties. In Michigan, abortion providers could soon face felony charges under an abortion ban that has remained on the books since 1931. But Karen McDonald, the Oakland County prosecuting attorney, said the law was useless and antiquated, comparing it to old statutes banning cows running at large. She said that she would not enforce an abortion ban. Ms. McDonald, a Democrat who supports abortion rights, said her office was already overburdened trying to address epidemics of gun violence, fentanyl overdoses, and domestic violence. She said she would not peel away resources to prosecute people for what she considered a constitutional right. But next door in Macomb County, Prosecutor Peter Lucido, a Republican, has said publicly that he would enforce the ban if it's upheld in court. The law has been suspended by a state judge after challenges from abortion rights groups. And in Grand Rapids, the Kent County prosecutor vowed to enforce the existing 1931 ban and prosecute doctors, saying he would not, quote, turn a blind eye and ignore what he called a valid law. Also on the front page, Brazil law sets a black market in abortion pills. Last November, Zania, a 23-year-old college student in northern Brazil, began exchanging text messages with a drug dealer in the south of the country. Following the dealer's instructions, she transferred 1,800 reais, or $285, her living expenses for several months. Then she waited three agonizing weeks for the arrival in the mail of a blister pack of eight unmarked white pills. When she took them, they had the effect she was hoping for. She underwent a medication abortion at home with her boyfriend, ending an eight-week pregnancy. But Zania kept bleeding for weeks, an unusual but not rare complication. It was like a murder scene every time I had to shower, she said. She was afraid to get help because it's illegal for a woman in Brazil to use the drug, misappropriate Prostol to trigger an abortion. If she went to a clinic, she feared the staff might figure out she had induced the abortion and report her. The penalty for having an abortion in Brazil is up to 3 years in jail. It's the loneliest feeling I've ever felt in my life, she said, asking to be identified only by her first name out of fear of prosecution. After 7 weeks, she went to a woman's clinic and admitted to having terminated a pregnancy. She was given a simple cauterization and no one reported her. Proponents of abortion rights in the United States have suggested that a post-Roe America would differ in a key way from the era before abortion was legalized nationally. Women seeking abortions today have the option of a medical termination using hormone pills to make the body expel the fetus in private, a practice approved by the Food and Drug Administration. But the wave of state trigger laws that have begun to take effect since the Supreme Court's ruling on Friday overturning Roe bar all abortions, including medication abortions. To get the pills legally, women would have to travel to states where it is allowed for a medical consultation, even if it is by video or phone, as required by the FDA. The trajectory of access to abortion pills in Brazil may offer insight into how medication abortions can become out of reach and what can happen when it does. While surgical abortion was the original target of Brazil's abortion ban, the proscription expanded after medication abortion became more common, leading to the situation today where drug traffickers control most access to the pills. Women who procure them have no guarantee of the safety or authenticity of what they are taking, and if they have complications, they fear seeking help. The story goes on. And from the international page, as Cairo destroys houseboats, legends are lost. Rowing up to the cheerful turquoise houseboat on the Nile, a fisherman saluted the white-haired woman swaying on its deck. "How are you holding up?" he called to the woman, Eklis Helmi, who's 88, as his wife dragged back the oars. "May God bring down the bully." This week may be their last sharing that particular stretch of the Nile, a narrow tract in central Cairo that since the 1800s has been lined with wooden houseboats, homes that double as living lore. This month, the government suddenly ordered Miss Helmsley's houseboat and 31 others demolished, saying that they were unsafe and unlicensed. More than half of the 32 structures connected to mainland Cairo by lush riverbank gardens have already been destroyed or towed away for scrap, with at least 14 of them disappearing on Tuesday alone. The rest, including Miss Helmsley's, are slated to go in early July. With them will fade the remnants of a glittering, fast-disappearing history. Divas hosted debauched salons on them. The Nobel laureate Naguib Mahfouz wrote a novel on one, and famous films were set on others. On the riverbank, life was peaceful, airy, and private, nothing like dusty, frenzied metropolis whose imagination the floating homes had captured for so long. Though the government has offered little information about its plans for the riverbank, residents say the authorities have increasingly pushed in recent years to replace residential boats with floating cafes and restaurants. That is in line with government plans to modernize and monetize much of Cairo by handing it over to private developers or the military, bulldozing several historic neighborhoods to build new high-rises, roads, and bridges.